just want to breathe for a second. So beautiful. Wow. So the first reading this morning is taken from Leslie Hazelton's mighty fine book, Jezebel. This is a remarkable and compassionate look at a biblical character named Jezebel, written about in the scroll of Malachim, or in English, the Book of Kings. Her husband was named Ahab, a name much more familiar to modern readers through the story of Moby Dick by Melville. However, this is not about Jezebel in this particular case, this part of the book. It's about Ahab.
The story, told as a standalone chapter in Kings, begins with a declaration of war. It is a surprise move on the part of Ben-Hadad, the king of Damascus, and a well-timed one. Ben-Hadad demands that Ahab cede the territory of Gilead to him and declares that he'll pummel Ahab's kingdom if he does not comply. "Your city, Samaria," he says, "is just a pile of dust compared to my strength." But Ben-Hadad underestimates the young king, who responds, "It is not the man who puts the armor on who should boast of his strength, but the one who takes it off." Ben-Hadad foolishly sees Ahab's unwillingness to fight as a sign of weakness instead of strength. By the time Ben-Hadad takes the field, his army is so large that Ahab's army looks like two herds of goats against them. But the king of Damascus is decisively defeated in a week-long battle. Ben-Hadad decides to surrender. His generals throw themselves on the ground before Ahab's tent. "Your servant Ben-Hadad begs you, O king, spare my life." They are taken aback by the reply. "What? Is he still alive?" says Ahab. But he continues, "He is my brother. Go bring him to me." "Your brother?" the general stutter. By ancient standards, this was all but unprecedented. So when Ben-Hadad arrives, Ahab extends the hand of peace and reaches down from his chariot and brings the defeated king up to stand beside him, not as a conquered enemy, but as a brother and ally. Ahab then takes off his own armor, and in doing so, proves the point about who should boast. A Zen master could not have done it better.
And the second reading this morning is a parable told by the famous rabbi from the 19th century, Chaim of Zance. It has been passed down through oral tradition, and I found this particular written form in a book with a collection of resources for the Jewish high holidays, which all of my Jewish friends are celebrating for the next few weeks.
Okay, so this man had been wandering around the forest for several days. He's tired and hungry, but he can't find the way out of the forest. Suddenly, as he rests in a little clearing, he notices someone else approaching through the thick undergrowth. A woman with a shawl on her head and a backpack. The man is suddenly filled with joy. "Now I can find my way out of this vast forest. She looks like she knows where she is going." She is surprised to see him when she breaks into the little clearing where he has stopped. He speaks right away. "Oh, my sister, can you please show me the way out of this tangle of trees? I have been wandering around lost for several days now." But the woman said to him, "Brother, I do not know the way out of this forest either. I too have been wandering around lost for several days. But I can tell you this, do not take the way I have been taking, for that will get you only more lost. And I won't be taking the direction you came from, since that too was a mistaken path. How about if we look for a new way together?
So 55 years ago, I seem to have already developed into a theological maverick. Our teacher, cluing us into church doctrine in the parochial school I attended, described God as omnipotent. Well, that's a kind of a fun word for a 10-year-old, isn't it? Omnipotent. It's fun in the mouth. None of us knew what it meant, of course, but we liked saying it. Sister Rosetta then went on to say, it means all-powerful, meaning that no one can be stronger than God. Even all of us together were not as powerful and strong as God, she said. Sister, if God is both omnipotent and can create things, can he create a stone that is so heavy he can't even pick it up? I don't remember how she answered exactly, but I do remember visually that she threw her head back, her eyes rolling up under her lids, as if she had finally reached the complete zenith of exasperation with her class of 10-year-old brats. Strangely, many years later, the word omnipotent came up in my life again. Not in theology this time, but in the context of a residential treatment center for, you guessed it, 10-year-olds who happen to be emotionally impaired. Some of these troubled kids would walk around the place with a style of strutting that made them into the alpha males of that ward. They bullied the younger ones, and they told the staff off quite arrogantly and securely. And then when we would chart about their day in the charts in the evening, we would use that word, omnipotent. Chris acted as if he was omnipotent all day long today. He smarted back to staff, swatted Curtis on the back of his head several times when he thought nobody was looking, and he pushed Mikey down onto the floor twice. Pure omnipotence, I would end my chart for the therapist to read. Now, obviously, Chris was not omnipotent theologically. He could not make a stone out of nothing, nor could he lift a boulder. But behaviorally, The word was a fair description of what he was doing. Omnipotent, like almost all the really fun words for the mouth, comes from potens in Latin, which means strong or strength. Now, in our congregational mission statement found on the walls outside on the teal lettering and in the backs of your order of service, you will find this line. I'll give it to you. We are here to claim diversity as a source of our strength. And this September, I'm trying to lift up specific words in our mission statement to unpack them a bit and point out their richness and their many dimensions. And I chose the word strength instead of the word diversity simply because diversity, that is, all the distinct parts that together make up the oneness of all reality, is pretty much all there is. There's nothing but diversity. I am not you. You are not me. Diversity. Sun is not moon. Diversity. Egg is not chick. Diversity. Stone is not water. Diversity. A 68-year-old woman selling small purple eggplants at a stall in Islamabad, Pakistan, is not the same as a 27-year-old woman in Columbus teaching yoga at Yoga on High. Diversity. Thus, our mission in this world is very clear. It's not to say, oh, we all think alike, we're all like-minded, or any of that stuff. That's not our mission. Sorry if you thought it was so. No, it's to relish, enjoy, struggle with all of our differences, theological, cultural, spiritual, and experiential, so much so that we are strengthened by our diversity, by our wrestling with diversity, and not pulled down by it. I think the children's story this morning illustrates this clearly. If we keep away from each other, isolate from each other because we don't agree with each other and we're waiting around for other people to suddenly get it right and agree with our way of thinking and our way of feeling, we are divided and we are weaker. If we form a community together despite our differences, then we are the stronger for it, since as the great Jewish teacher from the Galilee once put it succinctly 2,000 years ago, a community divided against itself cannot long survive. Precisely. Second, strength has to do not just with bodies, but with hearts. But strength is primarily, I think, often associated with sheer muscle power, muscle strength. My friend John called me the other day, excited about his progress in strength training. John is consciously and entirely deliberately trying to make himself the strongest guy on the planet, pound for pound, that is. He's not trying to be a bodybuilder, mind you. He's trying to be strong. He's not going to enter the Arnold Expo come March. He's just exercising to be strong, magnificently, ferociously, impossibly strong. John is not a giant physically. He is 5'6" tall, and until recently, he's weighed no more than 128 pounds. He's upped it by about 10 pounds since he moved to West Virginia this summer to work with children a lot like I used to work with at that residential center. But size and physical strength, mind you, are not related necessarily. John can bench press 350 pounds, which makes him way stronger than me. And probably makes him way stronger than any of you. After sharing his progress with me, he asked me if I had ever in my life thought of myself as strong. At first, I wanted just simply to say, are you kidding me, 350 pounds? Oh, my God. But I didn't say that. What I said is, well, I've never got close to benching 350 pounds, certainly. But I actually do think I'm actually strong in another area of my life. And that is in facing and grappling with experiences of loss. I buried the vast majority of people that I have met in my life by this age. And I yet can still show up and face another one because it's going to keep on happening until I myself end. Mind you, I said to John, my strength is not cool or aloof like some folks picture emotional strength. I cry like a baby on the floor in a fetal position when anyone dies. I scream, I keen, to use a word that's not used enough anymore. I cry like a baby, and I grieve for years afterward in different ways. But I grieve, and I'm strong in my grieving, and in that way, at least, I am strong, very strong. Cool, he said, getting what I meant. We're both strong. He did get it. And there's a lot of strength in this room. I'm hardly the strongest person here. Based upon all kinds of diverse experiences, not just of loss, but different experiences in family life, work life, unemployed life, aging life, health life, economic life, and so forth. And some of us, including me sometimes, have spent some days in our lives feeling a bit lost in all of this tangle of all these experiences. But then, like in the story told by Rabbi Chaim of Zantz, we might meet somebody in a community kind of like this or other communities, maybe in our family, maybe in a school, where we share our sense of being lost, even though we arrived into the tangle by different paths. And then we decide to work together to find a way out of the thicket. There is strength in working together, sharing our diverse experiences to come out with a better outcome for all of us. Thirdly, when I think of strength, I think of Leslie Hazleton's observations on the ancient story of Ahab. This reveals another aspect of strength. The story of Jezebel and Ahab is one of the most remarkable and most distorted in all of the Hebrew scriptures. And it's a big story. Jezebel is written about more than any other single woman in both the Hebrew scriptures and the Greek scriptures. Far more than Mary, the mother of Jesus, or Miriam, the sister of Moses. Far more. Written centuries after the actual historical events, and we do have archaeological evidence for these people, by the way, the historical events were given a very cruel spin, to use a modern word, by the author, a much later author, because he was trying to deal with situations, political situation, in his own era. So, as an example, he took the original name of the princess of Tyre in Phoenicia, Ahab's foreign-born spouse, a political marriage, and changed her name in order to degrade her. Her actual name was Ithbaal, which means the Lord's Lady. But the author renamed her in Hebrew Izebel, or Jezebel, as we say in English, which means Lady of Cow Dung. I couldn't help but think as I read about that degradation, as I read Hazleton's book, about how the conversations have been going on this past 2 weeks about the football player who knocked his fiancée out cold, recorded clearly on tape. The number of commentators who wanted to sweep aside such violence toward women under the rug astonished many, many people. And that astonished me, because I was not astonished. The degradation had begun at least 2,600 years ago when this story was written down for the first time. No, the actual Ithbaal, Jezebel, seems to have been a very modern, remarkable, and broad-minded ancient who was strengthened, not weakened, by the diverse religious cultures of her age. Her husband Ahab, as Hazleton points out, was also vilified by the later spin doctor. But in the standalone story that survived all the editorial shenanigans of a later era, he actually comes off, I think, quite remarkable. He was slow to go to war, even when clearly provoked by this crazy Ben-Hadad up in Damascus. And when he won the battle anyway, against all odds, he embodied the meaning of his philosophy of strength, which was, it is not the man who puts the armor on who should boast about his strength, but the one who takes it off. Indeed, as Hazleton says so wisely, by ancient standards, it was all but unprecedented. And I'd like to add, by modern standards, it's also almost entirely unprecedented. I'd like to suggest with Hazleton that Ahab's strength was inspired by his wife, his foreign-born wife, who was clearly made stronger in her new desert environment by grappling elegantly with the diversity around her. We claim, interesting to tell, this exact same strength for ourselves in this congregation. We strive to embrace all the differences in theology and philosophy and culture, which is often more important than the first two. How? By constantly bringing this idea up in worship service after service on Sunday after celebration. We bring it up in small covenant groups, study circles, grief groups, and in many classes for both our children and adults that we put together. Each of these engagements is an exercise in strengthening the spiritual muscles that enable us to grow stronger without falling for the distorted ideas of strength used by Ahab's foe, Ben-Hadad, boasting about his sheer capacity for military terrorism, as if that was the only meaning of strength. But the stories don't stop. This week, I visited Bill Hurley in the hospital. As you heard, if you listened to the caring card announcement, he underwent one hell of a surgery that lasted 12 hours. 12 hours. I had surgery once many years ago. It was much, much shorter. And I was so surprised when I went to visit him that he was sitting up, that he had color in his cheeks, and he was as energetic as he's ever been, just a couple of days after the surgery. I expressed my surprise, and he told me, and I have his permission to tell this story, that he had been riding his bicycle all summer long. Sometime in late May, he said, I want to ride a bike like I did when I was a kid. I want to ride bike. Got a bike, he started riding it. He got excited riding it, and he started riding all over the place. He rode far. He went all over the places he didn't think he had the strength to ride, but as the summer went on, he realized he could ride further and further and further because his body got stronger and stronger and stronger. Now, he didn't know he was going to have such serious surgery when he was riding his bike. The discovery of the condition that he had that needed surgery happened by coincidence sometime later, which was good that they found it by accident, because otherwise he'd be in trouble. Turns out all of these exercises strengthen him, his body and his heart. Turns out that he came through the invasive surgery with rosy cheeks because he had been bike riding. Turns out he had a lot to teach me about the meaning of strength, that strength comes not all at once like a miracle, but little by little. My friend John told me the same thing, basically. Strength is not something you get as a sudden gift, but it comes only with intention and regular practice as you exercise your body and your heart, as you negotiate and face the diverse and often difficult realities of life. Those are all exercises to strengthen. And as in the story of the six sticks that I told this morning to the children, and in the story of the forest where two people are lost and helping each other to find their way out, strength comes from working together, no matter how different we are, intentionally, to transcend that sense of being lost. I think of the work the Fair Food Ohio group has been doing, as Sue Carter reported earlier. People different in class, tremendously so, in color, in religion, in every possible way, working together to find a way out of the cruel forest where some have a living wage and can eat and others have a dead wage and cannot. And as the last story suggests, the strength that comes from diversity actually has the power to achieve something totally, surprisingly, and unbelievably unprecedented in the history of the world. Incidentally, when Bill recovers, he told me he's going to be continuing to ride his bike, and that next summer he intends to ride the Pelotonia, which is a very long ride indeed. Strength, after all, is not a state that's achieved once and for all. You keep on riding. You keep on strengthening and going forward. Come to think of it, there really isn't any such thing as strong all by itself. Just strengthening. And that, folks, is very, very good theology indeed.